But a moment agone, among men cursing and fighting and toiling, blinded I fought, but the labor passed on a sudden, even as a passing thought, and now alone, ah, to be ever alone, in the flowery valleys among the mountains and silent wastes untrod, in the dewy upland places, in the garden of God, this would atone.
Those are the cheery words of C.S. Lewis, not really the words we think of for C.S. Lewis.
Yeah, I think if you know C.S. Lewis from Narnia and Fuzzy Animals in the Woods, this grim, ready to die Lewis is just a whole different character, it seems like, and yet it's the same guy.
It seems to me this is a part of C.S. Lewis you have to understand the real C.S. Lewis. And that's what's going to be the fun part of this series. This is Cole Fakes, and I'm joined by Ben Williams and Terry Fakes here on the So We Speak podcast. And we're starting a C.S. Lewis series. We're going to do some episodes on his life, on his writings, what made him, and then the world that he made, literally. We'll dive into Narnia. We'll dive into some of his other fiction. And we'll especially dive into the impact that C.S. Lewis has had on the world afterwards, particularly in America. And we wanted to start by looking at what made C.S. Lewis. Who is C.S. Lewis? And I'll just say, guys, in doing the research for this, we've been reading for months, and it's been a joy to go back and read some things I'd read before and then read a lot of things I hadn't. I feel like I got to know C.S. Lewis all over again, learned a million things I didn't know about him. And he really became a 3D person, a real life flesh and bones person after doing some research on him.
And you know what surprised me? I have the same feeling, Cole. And what surprised me was the C.S. Lewis that I knew from reading his works later in his life. And the image I had of him when I read his biography and realized the first part of his life, it was a major disconnect for me. I did not know that part of C.S. Lewis.
I was surprised by how much C.S. Lewis I hadn't read. I fancy myself pretty knowledgeable about C.S. Lewis until I really started looking at what a C.S. Lewis bibliography looks like. And there were some major pieces of it I had never looked at. I'd never read the Space Trilogy somehow, even though I have an interest in astrophysics and C.S. Lewis, but had never read his Space Trilogy. I had never read On Miracles. I don't know how I missed that one, but got around to that. So it was really delightful to get to fill in some pieces that I had definitely missed, including a lot of his childhood.
Well, as our bibliography got longer and longer, which we'll release over the course of this podcast, but as our bibliography got longer and longer, it did get more and more interesting. And there was a whole new C.S. Lewis that began to emerge, and it was even more fascinating than I thought it would be. In this starter episode, what we want to do is look at the early life of C.S. Lewis. And this is the least known, least familiar section of Lewis's life. And coming to Lewis through his later books, you might imagine that C.S. Lewis had kind of an idyllic childhood and came up, and everybody knows that he was an adult convert to Christianity, but there's nothing that would signal in his popular works anything lurking in his childhood. But what you find out, and what we're going to cover in this episode, is he had a difficult childhood and a lot of suffering, a lot of joy. But more than anything, one of his biographers, who I've really enjoyed reading, Harry Lee Poe, has posited that in order to understand C.S. Lewis, you have to understand the first 15 years of his life. He says, it's become clear that most of the things that he liked and disliked had been settled by the time he was 17. He, during his school days, during his time with his tutor, Kirkpatrick, had pretty much determined the person he was going to be by the time he was a teenager. And so it's worth looking at that to say, what were the seeds that were being planted that would bear fruit for the rest of his life? The first thing that you might not know about C.S. Lewis is he's not English. C.S. Lewis is not an Englishman. He's an Irishman. And he was born in 1898. He was born into a family. He has one younger brother. And they had a very brief, idyllic, wonderful period in their life. They moved to Belfast into a house called the Little Lee, as they called it, in 1905. And it was a wonderful time. It was a great family. His father was working. His mother was with them, teaching them to read. She loved books. And she was everything that any child could want in a mother. And this period of Lewis's life kind of sets a foundation of what security and family and love and literature all combine into. And the vision of life that he had in this time period sets a standard that he spends the rest of his life kind of trying to get back to in certain ways. And so the early life, the first 7 years of Lewis's life, is a storybook childhood. This is everything that any kid would want.
I think everybody has some period in their life that they refer everything back to. It's not always the first period, but we all have one. If you go to like a small town high school football game, you'll see the guys down on the sideline who have no kids there and have no connection except they played there in yesteryear, and their best moments of their life were on that field, and they're still on the sideline just kind of hanging out trying to recapture that. Like, we all have some moment where we say those were the days. For Lewis, really, what, like, the first days he remembered and were in a sense short-lived, and trying to recapture that, it became more haunting than it did satisfying, because it there was a great moment, and then after that things did not go well, even though his family, I mean, financially fairly well to do by the standards of the day. I mean, he's not wanting for anything, but as a child, emotionally and socially, not getting what he needed to flourish after that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that's fascinating about that time period in his life is just how he always longs for home afterwards.
That's a good point, Cole, is, and as Ben said, that is his one memory of stability. And I think of it like one of those tower puzzles where you could take a brick out one at a time, and the puzzle, you know, the statue stands, but at some point when you pull one of the bricks out, the whole thing falls down. And as you look at that family, it looks like a great family, but when his mother dies of cancer when he's 10 years old, that one brick changes everything about their family, not just about his life, but it changes the whole family dynamics. And that idyllic period ends early in his life.
I was thinking of that exactly. And you compare things to your own life and my two sons. My wife had cancer, breast cancer, a few years ago, and survived it and is doing great now. But for my older boy, he's old enough that memory is still something he refers back to, is the time when mom had cancer and his life was not as certain of how things would go. And you can see even now, a couple of years later, that he thinks of things through that lens of, am I being a burden to mom and dad because they've got it rough? My little one, who's younger, just 4 years younger, but for him, barely remembers that at all, and completely different experience of childhood. And so we probably undervalue how much those experiences create the lens that we see a lot of other things through. And so it was easy for me, just because of my kids and how they saw that, to imagine then my own father lost his mother when he was 8. And he does talk about there was an idyllic time, and then there were the times that follow. And that really does shape how you view the events that happen afterwards.
Well, Ben, as you described, this is exactly what happens for C.S. Lewis. This is the turning point in his life. This is the line between the idyllic childhood and everything that's going to follow. And if you were just marking a map of C.S. Lewis's life, what you essentially have is that first image of what a family is like, what a home is like, what love is like, what joy is like. And then after that, you have a long sojourn in the far country of suffering and alienation and feeling like an outsider. And of course, as you mentioned, in 1908, when his mother passes away, he's 11 years old. And she's briefly sick from cancer and then passes away. And she passes away on his dad's birthday, which leads to an interesting storyline. The break in their family isn't just the sorrow of losing his mom. It's the breakdown of the relationship with his dad that follows. You know, his dad has two boys that are coming of age, needing to go to school, and essentially has no idea what to do with them. He's emotionally distant from them. He has great intentions, but doesn't always follow through. He's very unlike C.S. Lewis. And so what you see is not just an unraveling of a boy losing his mother, you see a family unraveling. And C.S. Lewis's dad and his sons are never close again in the same way that they were before this. And that becomes an interesting theme in his life. One of the things that really struck me with this episode about his mom dying is how much of some of these early memories start to show up in the Chronicles of Narnia. So C.S. Lewis is reflecting in some ways on these deep, deep human experiences to write the Chronicles of Narnia. And one of the things that we'll get to when we talk about the Chronicles of Narnia is how somebody like Lewis wrote such amazing children's books having never had little kids. And part of that has to be because he was remembering his own childhood and the authenticity of reliving those memories and working those out in the Chronicles of Narnia. Sometimes I would think even subliminally really resonated with the people who are reading them. So, you know, one scene, just as an example, is if you've read The Magician's Nephew, you'll remember one of the driving lines of that book is that Diggory is trying to find some way to save his dying mother. And so in the opening of the book, you have this image of Diggory's mother laying in her bed, propped up on her pillows, pale and sick looking. And then, of course, when he goes on this grand adventure, he's trying to find something to bring back to his mother and save her, which he does. And it's a mirror image in some ways of Lewis, who couldn't do anything to save his mother, and now is kind of applying that balm to his own heart and his own soul through writing this story. And there's a lot of the Chronicles of Narnia in his later writings that make a lot of sense given what happened to him as a kid.
There's a quote from P.D. James that all fiction is largely autobiographical. And of course, most autobiographies is largely fiction. That you almost get to see more of authors in the stories they make up, because you get that inner life that was so rich for Lewis, especially.
Well, I was struck too by how the relationship between the boys and their father is never the same. But I wasn't surprised by the reaction of their father. It seemed like in that time period, when something like this happened, you know, you've got a father trying to make a living, you've got these children, in this case, two boys. And what you did in that society was you'd ship them off to boarding school, basically put their upbringing in someone else's hands. And that's essentially the path that was followed here.
Cole, yeah. you're a Harry Potter fan like I am. And for me, the idea of getting shipped off to school is, you know, almost like fairy tale. When I read Harry Potter, it's like no one does that. And then reading Lewis's life, it's, oh, that's actually quite normal at that time and place, and in a lot of life in that world. It's not just a quirky device for the fiction of fun children's books.
Yeah, the boarding school life that you get to look in over Lewis's shoulder is really different than what you're thinking about in Eton and Hogwarts and all these prestigious boarding schools. His experience at these schools was terrible. In fact, in Surprise by Joy, he describes his time at a boarding school as a concentration camp. And of course, he's writing this after real concentration camps, looking back at it. And some of his biographers have said this kind of insensitive to compare boarding school that you're paying a fortune for with concentration camps. But this was his experience. I mean, he's coming out of this great tragedy. And McGrath, I think, puts this really well. He talks about the moment that the boys leave for boarding school. He says, an emotionally unintelligent father bade his emotionally neglected sons an emotionally inadequate farewell and sent them to boarding school. That's what Lewis was walking into. Of course, his older brother had already been there, and he joins him a couple of times. And Warnie, his older brother, seems to have had a little bit different experience at the schools than C.S. Lewis did. But it was miserable for both of them. And apparently at this time, it was miserable for a lot of people going to these boarding schools. So the first school that he goes to is a school called Wynyard School. And in 1908, so he's about 10. This is right after his mother dies. He's 11, maybe. Or right before his mother dies, he goes off to this school and he's beaten. He's abused. We would call it just an absolute widespread case of abuse. The schoolmaster ends up getting the school shut down because he goes crazy. We'd probably diagnose him with several different things. But Lewis writes during this time that his academic life there was basically worthless. He didn't learn anything. And the wounds inflicted on him would last for the rest of his life in terms of his emotional abuse that he suffered there. One of the quotes when he's reflecting back on this in Surprise by Joy that I keep thinking about is this concept that joy in his life was not just absent, but forgotten in the time that he was at school. Of course, the same thing is true when he moves on to the next school at Malvern. This is a brighter spot in the history, in the history of his life. He falls in love with mythology here. He picks up some of the things that he'll really love, classical literature. But at the same time, he's emotionally neglected. He doesn't fit in with the other boys. He doesn't have any sense of belonging. He's not getting any support from his dad. These early years, what we'd consider kind of the middle school years, are hard for anybody, but especially for Lewis. This seems to be a low point in his life.
You know, it'd be easy to dismiss some of it as first world problems. You know, he didn't enjoy his private school and stuff like that. But for a kid, that was rough. He's lost his mother. He doesn't fit in where he is. He doesn't enjoy the things that others enjoy. And always feels isolated and alone, such that the only maybe three constancies, and one of them's fishy. One would be academics, which, as you say, sometimes goes well and sometimes doesn't. His relationship with his brother, whenever he's near his brother, things are going well. And then his inner imaginary life become the three focal points of his childhood through these experiences.
Well, Cole, one interesting question I had as I read through it is I know that in that era, the abuse and the hard life, you know, there was this idea that teach the boy's character by ways that today would get you put in jail. But I understand that. But why do you think he didn't fit in? What about him made him not fit into that system?
You know, one of the things doing the research for this that has popped out to all of us is just that C.S. Lewis was kind of an odd guy. He wasn't like other boys, both internally and what he thought about, what he longed for, but then the circumstances also that took place in his life. So one thing I had never heard before was that C.S. Lewis was born with this strange deformity in his thumbs where the last digit of his thumb didn't bend. So he didn't have a lot of dexterity with his hands. So he was clumsy. He was not good at sports. Of course, this manifests later in life. He never learns to type because he can't really. It's not just that he's a Luddite and anti-technology, which he was in certain ways. It's that he physically couldn't type in a way that was efficient enough to make it worth his time. He always had a typist do it for him. And the biographers make some interesting, they draw some interesting conclusions from this thing with his thumb. Some downplay it, some don't. Some really think that this is the key to understanding Lewis. I'm somewhere on the side of this is a significant key to understanding him, because then and now, one of the things that gets you accepted in middle school if you're a boy is athletic prowess. And C.S. Right. Lewis was no athlete. I mean, he was a klutz. He was very clumsy. He always got picked last. In fact, sometimes you read about kids are going to play a game and they lie to Lewis about it so that he doesn't feel so bad. But then, of course, he finds out that they were going to play without him, and he does feel terrible afterwards. But Poe, he makes the biggest deal out of this, and he thinks that this feeling of being an outsider is actually more significant to Lewis and understanding him than his mother's death. He says, a mother's death at least brought sympathy and attention to Lewis. For him, the greatest example of the universe being against him came from his own clumsiness. His efforts of tying a knot or trying to make something straight always had a comic effect. And when things have a comic effect, people laugh. Lewis was the cliche of a clumsy oaf.
I think we can say that forced him to hunt for joy elsewhere. because it didn't fall into his lap. If you're not getting satisfaction from ordinary exchanges and relationships, you look elsewhere. And he did develop this robust inner life, this imagination, where before it was cool, before Marvel did it, he has his own extended universe of animals and lore. And I'm imagining this kid off by himself, just dreaming up the adventures of the badger and the horse. You know, he had this interest, very childlike, in animals doing human things. And so in his little fantasy world, he imagined that. And again, I don't know if that's going back to that childhood moment or something, but it lived in him throughout his life. I mean, like, there was a consistent universe. It wasn't just episodes of it, but a consistent universe, so much so that he would say later, it would be easy to compare Narnia to his animal world. And he would say, oh no, they're different universes. Like, they weren't just an extension, but that had its own lore and universe, and it had its own encyclopedia in his head of characters and history, whereas Narnia was somehow a different one he made that was similar, I suppose. But that's how robust and well articulated it was in his mind, that he spent that much time in his own imagination.
Mm. Yeah, inner life. I love that you put a name on that, because, you know, many kids daydream. Not many kids are creating worlds with backstories and mythologies and stories like Lewis and like Tolkien, actually, you know, who he meets later in life. These enormous universes in their minds, and not as much in terms of escapism as it is in wonder. This is the way that Lewis actually expresses the deeper things of life, is through these stories, these narratives, these worlds that he lives in. And you start to see early in his life that image is actually one of the most important things to Lewis. He almost thinks in terms of these plots and images and stories in a way to express what's going on inside of him. Another thing that will put you on the outs with middle school boys is thinking in images like this, as opposed to just, you know, grunting your way through life and playing sports. But this isolation that Lewis experiences starts to hollow out this giant cavernous capacity for meaning and myth and story and wonder in his life.
It is interesting to me, Cole, that because I thought at first when I was reading the biography, this is a typical story of escapism, but he never gets lost there. He never treats it stereotypically like an escape from reality. It really does seem more like a development of a part of his character as opposed to an escape from the rest of his life. And there's a distinction there that I didn't really understand until I followed him, because had he just been escaping, you wouldn't expect him to be successful later in life. And as we'll get to in a minute, he ends up at Oxford and he ends up, you know, having a career. He's not a, quote, loser in school. It's almost like this pressure forced him to just let a piece of him flower that might not have ever flowered otherwise.
Yeah, he discovers his true loves during this period of his life. So that flourishing ends up being the thing that makes him who he is as an Oxford Don later in life. So it's actually at Malvern, when he's in his early teens, that he falls in love with mythology. And one of the things he falls in love with is Wagner's Ring Saga. And he gets a hold of the libretto. So when you have an opera, you also have the script almost, and the development of the script that the composer will write. And right about the time that Lewis is falling in love with mythology, he comes across these volumes of the librettos from The Ring. And they have these great illustrations by Arthur Rackham. And he just falls in love with the mythology, the Norse mythology of the Ring Saga. And this part of him actually continues through his whole life. He's, of course, a professor of medieval literature later in life. And medieval literature is these great sagas and the epics and poetry and the expression of these deep values about human nature and heroism and beauty and truth. That's what Lewis falls in love with. And that's what actually makes his scholarly career. He has a little bit of a winding path academically to figure that out. But that love is in him from early in his teenage years all the way through the end of his life.
He seems to fall in love with everything else, or everything that the rest of society is getting over and moving on. He'll admit, and the way he says it is interesting, that he was, you know, guilty of romanticism, you know, like an admission, not romance in the loving kind of way, but in the era of chivalry and knights and dragons, like that he had that chivalrous bent to him that comes out of this love of myth, of medieval literature and the myths that preceded it. At exactly the time that the world was tilting full into modernity and the kind of scientistic utilitarian morality that's so different and so opposite and even disdainful of the medieval point of view, Lewis was rediscovering that and saying, boy, that matches up best with what I experience in my internal life and the way I wish the world was. I think he has a lot of moments where he finds out the world does not seem to be that way, where I think it creates some sadness and even despair at various times in his life because he believed the world should be one way. And by the time he, not to skip ahead too far, but by the time he gets to trench warfare in World War I, that's as far from chivalry and the medieval story as you could possibly get.
That is a really good point. It's almost like by this point in his life, as this begins to flower, I wonder, Cole, you said, used a phrase, the pursuit of joy. And there's a sense in which you can look at his early life as a pursuit of joy, or perhaps a rediscovering that idyllic period earlier in his life. And it seems like the gateway for that is this part of his personality. But one question I had for you guys, and this surprised me a little bit when I read this, and it took me a little to understand what he was meaning, but the difference between joy and the anticipation or thinking of joy, what was going on there with C.S. Lewis?
Well, I love that distinction, and I've been thinking about it through all this reading we've done in prep for this podcast. The idea that joy and thinking about joy are incompatible, like there's a wall between those two things, those two activities, that enjoyment is something that happens precisely when you're not thinking about it. And then later you're thinking about it and you're not experiencing it. Joy is always something you remember because you're not noticing it because you're enjoying it. You can't notice it and enjoy it at the same time. The good old days are always past. It's always something that has happened because when you are in the good old days, you don't know it. You're just enjoying it. For him, that, as Cole mentioned, that idyllic childhood moment that was so fleeting, every time he thinks about it, he can't experience it. And instead, the more he chases it, harder it is to grab because the expectation of it just can't be recaptured. And so there's a reason his own autobiographical work is Surprised by Joy, is that that's the arc, in his thinking at least, of his whole life, was the impossibility of recapturing it, and yet the pursuit of it itself taught him so much. He learned by not having it the meaning of what it was to have it and pursue it. And I don't think that is a thought. I think that's one of those you're supposed to really chew on a long time. Like you can say it quickly. Lewis is so quotable, right? Mm-hmm. Joy is always remembered. That's quick and easy. But then you could spend weeks thinking about that and how much even nostalgia gets in the way of present tense joy, or expectations prevent us from joy, or the foolishness of trying to recapture what has been. Do you remember the scene? I want to say it's in Ezra. It might be Nehemiah, but they've rebuilt the temple and everybody's celebrating, except there are some people who seem to remember the way the old temple was, and they're mourning. So again, there's this expectation, well, it's not like it was, and they miss out on the joy everybody else is having because they are thinking about it. They're not to be against, but their expectation got in the way of the good thing God did, and they missed out on it, as it were.
Yeah, that's a great example of the temple. The former glory, you know, will exceed the present glory. And people are like, how? This is a shanty compared to what we had before, you know, but God is going to do that. And the same is true with Lewis in some ways. His first experience of joy is early in life. And then he thinks, I'll never be able to attain that again. That's that thinking about it, but not experiencing it. And I'll admit to you guys, I had never read Surprised by Joy until we started this. And I thought Surprised by Joy was Joy Davidman that he's going to end up marrying later. Right. I thought that's what it was. but it's not. It's this joy, Ben, that you've been talking about that he encounters early, loses, but is longing for. And then in the next episode, when we talk about his conversion, finds again. He finds true joy with a capital J. The way he defines it in Surprised by Joy is really fascinating. He's talking about these three moments in his early life where he's reading something and he comes across lines or themes that just stop him in his tracks. Autumn, the Balder the Beautiful. I mean, they seem so insignificant. And he says, to the reader who finds these three episodes of no interest, need read this book no further. For in a sense, the central story of my life is about nothing else. He says, I call it joy, which is here a technical term and must be sharply distinguished from both happiness and from pleasure. Joy, in my sense, has indeed one characteristic and only one in common with them. The fact that anyone who has experienced it will want it again. Apart from that, and considered only in its quality, it might almost equally well be called a particular kind of unhappiness or grief. But then it is a kind we want. I doubt whether anyone who has tasted it would ever, if both were in his power, exchange it for all the pleasures in the world. But joy is never in our power, and pleasure often is.
Well said. And when I read that, I really had to chew on that for a while. But experientially, I'll just say it this way. The more I thought about it, the more experientially true I realized that it was, that there's a bittersweet piece of joy and the longing for joy that you want that experience. It's a deep thought, but it resonated with me, and I wondered what you guys thought about it. But it's not one that you come across unless you've read Surprised by Joy.
Yeah, I had never encountered the notion, and until Lewis, and it has a lot of staying power for me, and it fits. I think Lewis would say it fits the shape of the gospel narrative of God fixing broken things, and that good gives way to bad, gives way to better, is, you know, the gospel arc all the way through, that something dies and then what God makes of it's better, that you do have to pass through all those stages. And Lewis's life definitely mirrors that, and the struggles through school, and then right as he's starting to feel like he finds a place in the academic world, there's a world war and all of its awfulness breaking out, that what he's looking for just seems a little further out of reach every time he grasps for it.
You know, what came to my mind, Cole, I won't get this quote right, but I think you will at that time, and I'll connect the dots here, but that Chesterton quote about fighting in a losing battle. The idea of being surprised by joy, maybe you can quote that a little better than I can, but that feeling of your expectations getting turned on their head at the last minute.
Yeah, I think that Chesterton quote is, he says, there's no greater pleasure in this life than to fight a losing battle and not lose. And that goes perfectly with this idea that Lewis is discovering in this idea of joy. It also actually goes perfectly with Tolkien's idea of the eucatastrophe, the good catastrophe that changes everything. And of course, Tolkien sees that in the cross, and Lewis is going to find ultimate joy in the cross. But they're both these wonderful yet awful, satisfying yet longing inducing realities that you experience in life.
Well, and you know, if you think about it, that idea is something you can see later in your life, the good catastrophe, the surprised by joy, because in this phase of his life, he's becoming basically, by the time he's 15, he's basically an atheist. And, you know, tracking what we've talked about his life, you realize there's not a lot of pleasant circumstances in his life, and there's not a lot of joy. He's in the catastrophe part, not the good catastrophe. He's in the, I'm fighting a losing battle and I'm not going to win this, or my life will never be more than this. And this is the phase where we have him. We get the advantage, and as did he when he wrote his autobiography, of realizing in some way this was the precursor to being surprised by joy. And I personally took a little comfort in that, because we all walk through those times, and having seen this perspective on it, it gives us a little hint that, you know, this is not the final chapter of the story.
There's no one more depressed than a disappointed romantic. I mean, who has such high expectations for how the world should be, and constantly having that shattered. I first encountered Lewis's early poetry a couple of years back, and I remember thinking, this can't possibly be C.S. Lewis, because it's still, the artistry's there, but it's so painfully depressing as a guy who had real chivalrous romantic ideas about the way the world should go and had just been presented with the opposite all the way along.
Yeah, if there's nothing better than winning a losing battle, there's nothing worse than losing the losing battle. And for a lot of C.S. Lewis's childhood, that's where he was.
Well, and not to skip forward too much, but, you know, we've kind of talked about the boarding school. We've talked about, you know, him being forced to have this piece of his life flowering, this inner life flowering. But then he ends up, the next thing you would think, well, this story will have a nice little ending. He'll find joy. He actually finds World War I, which was the greatest, most depressing, most horrible event, you could argue, in the whole century.
Yeah, right when he gets a break, he writes to his dad and tells him how terrible school is. He wants to leave. His dad arranges with a private tutor to take him out of school and go and learn at this private tutor's house. And the tutor's name is William Thomas Kirkpatrick. And he is a really eccentric, interesting guy. He's a kind of a Renaissance man meets Victorian, stoic, rigid Englishman. He instructs Lewis in the classics. He instructs him in literature. He certainly sows into this inner life that Lewis is developing. One of his biographers says, in The Weight of Glory, Lewis asks us to imagine a young boy who learned Greek in order to experience the joy of studying Sophocles. Lewis was that young boy, and Kirkpatrick was his teacher. In some ways, Kirkpatrick was a perfect match for Lewis because he appreciated things like the drama of Sophocles. But one of the lasting things that made an impact on Lewis was that he was a pretty militant atheist. He was a rationalist. He was very scientific in the way that he thought about the universe, and he passed that on to Lewis. And just as Lewis is really settling in with him and growing and starting to thrive intellectually, you have World War I. And he's conscripted. He is deployed in November of 1917. And in another sense, kind of a miserable grace, he's injured by a German shell that actually kills the soldier he's standing next to. And in April of 1918, so he's really only there for about 6 months, which is good in World War I because the casualty rates were so catastrophic on the front lines. He's wounded. He is brought back. He's recovering. And he essentially sits out the rest of the war. And he's able to go back to Oxford after that. But the war, he carries the war with him forever. But he was spared maybe dying in the war, like so many of the people at Oxford that he knew did, by that shell that wounded him.
Now, his roommate, Patty Moore, dies in the war in 1918, same time that Lewis is getting sent home. And you know, Cole, you and I in the last couple of years finished doctoral work. Can you imagine somewhere in the middle of doctoral work getting shipped off to trench warfare? I mean, the discontinuity of those two experiences and then your own injury and then losing friends, the one we know of, but presumably others. And then coming back and being expected to step right back into Oxford and get your triple first, you know, just what a jarring roller coaster of experiences.
Well, and that incident, by the way, as Cole said, was pivotal in ways he couldn't know. Being wounded probably likely kept him alive. But also losing his roommate turns out to be a pivotal thing as his life proceeds as well, because he had made a promise, or they'd made a promise to each other, that if one of them died, the other would take care of their family. And this leads into one of the more significant relationships in his life.
Yeah, Patty Moore's mother, is known as Mrs. Moore throughout Lewis's life and his letters, becomes a significant piece, and in fact, a second family for Lewis. And in a way that we'll talk about as we move through Lewis's life, a very significant portion of both his emotional and his physical life. In fact, later on, when he's an Oxford Don, he's traveling out to the countryside to this ever-changing rotation of homes that Mrs. Moore is living in. And in some ways, this is Lewis's attempt to get back to the place that he had wanted to be, in the Little Lee with his family, with his mother, before this terrible season, this loss of joy happened. And so there's glimpses, there's little seeds, whether it's his time with Kirkpatrick, whether it's the inner life that he develops, whether it's the poetry and the myth that he loves, whether it's trying to rekindle this idea of family with Mrs. Moore, this dreadful period of his life has everything in it that will create the C.S. Lewis that we know later. In fact, I'll go back to this idea from Poe's biography that he devotes so much time, Lewis devotes so much time to his childhood in Surprised by Joy, because he also realizes that you can't understand Lewis as a Christian until you understand Lewis as that miserable middle schooler at boarding school with joy faintly disappearing from his life. He says at one level, his later conversion seems to be the inevitable consequence of a number of decisions he made in late childhood and adolescence about what he liked and what he did not like.
I think the relationship with Mrs. Moore is probably, it is oversimplified, but is an example of him looking back for joy. Whereas when he gets to, and I know we're not there yet, but when we meet the Inklings, he gets brought into a future joy of other opportunities for joy. But that relationship, connected both to the death of his own mother and the loss of his roommate, is this backward-looking relationship, which is why it's always such an awkward relationship to talk about in the biographies. And for his friends even to understand, they look at it and think, what is this even? Because it is this backward-looking relationship.
You know, as I think about it, as we've traveled in this episode from, you know, the joy at the beginning and then the challenges and a faint glimmer here and there, but by the time World War I ends, and if I size up his life, I could put myself in his position and think that there would never be anything bright ever again in life. And that's not the C.S. Lewis I think of, but I think that's the C.S. Lewis in 1919.
Yeah, he publishes, I think it's his first poem published outside of a school journal in 1919. And it's the one we opened the episode with. It's titled, real cheery title. It's titled Death in Battle. And it's the year after he's come home from World War I. And it's as miserable as you can imagine. And the glimmer of hope, this joy-seeking facet of Lewis, is maybe after I die, the world I dreamed could be is there. Like, it's not theism, it's not Christianity by a yard, but just that he's still insistent that world ought to exist somewhere. And so the end of the poem, I shall not see the brutal crowded faces around me that in their toil have grown into the faces of devils, yea, even as my own, when I find thee, O country of dreams, beyond the tide of the ocean, hidden and sunk away, out of the sound of battles, near to the end of day, full of dim woods and streams. And there's a romantic, thoroughly disappointed, and yet still looking for something. I mean, this is a guy speaking out as a minister and not as a historian by any stretch. This is a guy God has primed to hear the gospel from a friend. And it's only through that can you understand what happens next for him becoming, what does he say, the least likely convert in all of England.
Well, we'll leave our hero there in despair at the end of World War One, back at Oxford, searching for joy, but primed and ready to become the most unlikely convert in the next episode.
Thanks for listening to the So We Speak podcast. If you like what you hear, go ahead and leave a comment, leave a review, email us, tell us what you like about it, tell us what you'd improve about it. Thanks to all you guys who are listening, and we'll see you next week on the So We Speak podcast.